Sisters and brothers, ladies and gentlemen, this memorial service will be concluded with the singing of Joe Hill. Will you please remain seated until the family has filed out of the auditorium?
As it is with all of us today, my heart is overloaded with grief. So if I should falter in paying this tribute to this great brother, leader, then I'm sure you will forgive me. Today the world mourns the loss of a great and good man. And the poor, the underprivileged, the oppressed, and poor, for they have lost a champion. Our union mourned the loss of a great leader, and we must face the months and years ahead without his vision and his spirit to guide us. But I, and hundreds of other veterans of our union like myself, have lost a great, warm, and personal friend, for we knew him and worked with him before his name became a household word in America. He was our comrade in arms, and with him we shared hardship and hope, joy and despair, tears and laughter, yes, and even disagreement. There are so many memories. I remember the day three of us stood on a windy corner in this city in 1935, and he told us he had found a room that could be rented for $10, $10 a month for a headquarters for the organizing drive on the west side of Detroit. And between the three of us, we didn't have $10. I remember the day I went with him to the home. Well, when he asked me to give him $2 from their meager household budget to buy a tank of gas for his car so that he could call on some workers and talk to them about the union. And she gave it to him, although it was sorely needed for other things, for May was a generous and loving woman, a fitting helpmate, who not only understood his aspirations and his goals, but who shared them as well. I remember all the years that came after, the strikes and the picket lines, the many rounds of negotiations when we either hit the bricks or waited on the sidelines for him to work his magic at the bargaining table. I remember the inch-by-inch progress upwards, the escalator clause, the too old to work, too young to die slogan, sub-benefits, group insurance, vacation pay and paid holidays, and much, much more. It came slowly and painfully, but when we put it all together, it meant a new life and a new world for the workers in the plants. And in 1966, there were nearly 200,000 of us retired on pensions. And I remember the day he called a small group of us into his office and said that he was going to propose a new organization to the next convention, an organization of retired members within our union. He knew us so well. He knew that making a pension possible was only giving us half a loaf. He recognized our need to stay in the mainstream of life and not to be shunted to one side because we were no longer a part of the working force. He gave us dignity and status as retired workers, and we shall be eternally grateful to him for it. And lastly, I remember last month in Atlantic City when I swore him in as president of this great union. In the years between 1930s and 70s, his name became known throughout the world. He walked with kings and presidents, and he numbered world leaders amongst his personal friends. But the man I administered the oath of office to last month, and the young man I talked with on the windy corner so long ago, remained the one and the same. His dreams and his desires never changed. He dreamed of a world where children were never hungry, a world where all men walked together in freedom and brotherhood, and men of all races and creeds lived together in mutual respect, and above all, a world where there were peace amongst nations. His last public statement was a call for the end to the horrible war we are now engaged in. He did not live to see this kind of world, this world he visualized. Perhaps none of us will. But in his years upon this earth, he touched the lives of millions of people and made them better. From the faceless, nameless auto workers of the 30s to the struggling grape pickers of the 60s, men responded to his call to unite in the battle for human dignity and justice. Men listened to him, loved him, and followed him, and above all, trusted him. He gave them the greatest gift of all, a knowledge of their individual worth as human beings. No individual or group of individuals were ever too small or too weak to claim his attention, and no individual or group of individuals too large or too powerful to escape his wrath. His voice was a call to the conscience of man, and now that voice is still forever. And it is almost more than we could bear. Water was a religious man, and his creed a simple one. He believed, and I've heard him say, that before man could serve God, he must prove himself worthy by serving mankind. I quote from the address to the last convention of the CIO in 1955 when he said, there is no greater calling than to serve your brother. There is no greater contribution than to help the weak. There is no greater satisfaction than to have done it well. In farewell, Walter, let us say, that you have done it well, very well indeed. And from the bottom of our grateful hearts, we thank you. And may I say to Victor, to the entire family, our love and our deep condolences go out to them from the group particularly that I represent, the veterans of this great union.
We meet here today not so much to discuss Walter Reuther's life, but to read his will, to examine his legacy. When I say his will, I mean that unwritten document that he spent a lifetime composing. and everyone in this auditorium today is an heir. He enriched the lives of thousands of people who might not even be able to recognize his name, and he never required that those he helped be able to recognize his name. Dave Miller eloquently has described the merits of the great union he built. But you didn't have to carry a UAW card to be one of Walter Reuther's constituents. He never asked much in the way of credentials. You were a part of Walter Reuther's constituency if you were poor, powerless, a consumer, an outdoorsman, if you are old, if you are sick, if you are weak, and if you are just. History will treat him kindly, not because he had a large constituency, but because he served it so well, not because he was in a position to make many decisions, but because so many of his decisions were right. History will not forget that he was one of the first in the nation to begin talking about what is now such a popular theme, national priorities. When nearly everyone else was still complacent about a national priority system that had stopped making sense years ago, Walter Reuther was wondering how often we should pick up rocks from the moon when our cities couldn't pick up garbage. And if opponents of that senseless war in Indochina ever muster the political muscle to shut it down, Walter Reuther's name will be in the books as one of the movers. And they'll write this down about him. He was not a selfish man. That's why we have so much to inherit. He's left noble structures, but on each he was the carpenter, not the foundation. Too often, leaders measure their own greatness by gauging their own indispensability. Walter Reuther knew better than that. Indispensable men leave no legacy, no monument apart from their gravestones. He was as much a teacher as a leader, content, even pleased, to see his ideas pressed to fruition by others whose enthusiasms he'd kindled. He's left us great organizations, but he's left us more. He's left a superb philosophy of trade unionism. He's left a legacy of selfless morality. His is a heritage of energy, dedication, and enlightened liberalism. And no one, not one of us, discharges his obligation to Walter Reuther by coming to his funeral. His estate must not be wasted. It must not be dissipated by cynicism or squandered in petty struggle. His estate must be husbanded. It must be conserved. And it must be carefully spent toward a compassionate, concerned, and courageous society. That was his life and goal. That must be our goal.
I have come to speak of Mrs. Walter Reuther. There were several things which were quickly learned in a personal relationship with Mrs. Reuther. First of all, she was careful and deliberate about activities which involved time outside her home. This was not the result of unwillingness to give of her time, but rather a measure of her spirit and her generosity, because once she was convinced that an organization had goals, commitments, and programs which were in the range of her interests and in the spirit of her broad philosophy about people, she devoted extensive amounts of time to learning about the organization, and she shared her thinking and her suggestions willingly. She was without pretense, an open, approachable, gentle spirit with a commanding intellect, who quickly absorbed ideas and information. She was an endless searcher and a learner who displayed an intense interest in an understanding of the major problems facing large urban areas. She sought out additional information on critical issues, made it a point to know students' points of view, and in the process, influenced others to be more thoughtful and open in their outlooks. It was important to her that young people, be they 4 years of age or 20 years of age, be dealt with as carriers of potential to be developed, and that they be taught and responded to in open, honest, and encouraging ways. She had firm convictions about people and the need for each of us to have greater faith in and place greater reliance on the talent and potential of people to control their own destinies and plan their own affairs. Although a national figure who knew many of the prominent persons of our time, who lived through periods of danger for the safety of her family, who persevered in the difficult early phases of the labor movement, her sensitive feelings for people and their welfare was never blunted. Behind the soft voice, the slow but easy smile, and the genuinely shy manner, there was an enormous wealth of conviction, experience, and clear thinking in areas which ranged from civil rights to concern for the growth of children and the new ways in which domestic and international peace might be achieved. Those who were privileged to know her, to work with her, to profit from her ideas and suggestions, thereby had a small insight into how she could be a strong source of support and counsel to a courageous and vigorously progressive man. Mrs. Ruther was unafraid of change, and on a number of occasions she spoke of how change would be forced on individuals and organizations in an abrupt fashion if they were not wise enough to recognize the signs and plan for change from their own motivation. Although she was unconcerned about controversy, she placed great stress on the responsibilities which people and organizations have to seize upon the opportunities to be facilitators in difficult and emotionally charged situations. In carrying out her responsibilities as a member of the managing board of a private institution, she revealed her convictions through her actions. In our efforts to create new research and training programs geared to the 1970s, focused on young children and families in urban situations, she quietly but firmly and enthusiastically supported aspects which focused on involving members of the community in planning and implementation of those programs, and she gave strong encouragement to our increased efforts to recruit minority students to our campus. She was respected by the young, admired by those who were older, and for all, she served as a vivid reminder that there is hope that we can solve even our most complicated and difficult problems if we press ourselves to use all of our talents and our energy. She was, by extraordinary measures, a significant and impressive human being. We shall miss her deeply. We shall miss her repeatedly in the time ahead.
We mourn today. We mourn the loss of Walter Ruther and his lovely wife. We mourn the tragic and untimely passing of noble souls, of dear friends, and of principled fighters for social justice. Walter Ruther was my friend. He was the best kind of friend, a man you could call in the middle of the night when you had a problem, a man who had the capacity to give of himself, a man who was always there when you needed him, always with the right word, the right advice, the right attitude of concern and involvement. I spoke at his union's convention. I saw how his members loved him and how they respected his judgment and revered his greatness. I saw the value they placed on his leadership
and I saw how he had influenced a huge union to support those in our society who were less fortunate than they. They have lost their leader. I have lost a dear friend. And all Americans, most especially the black, the poor, the underprivileged, have lost a champion. Whenever the going was tough, Walter Reuther was with us. He was at the 1963 march on Washington. He was in Selma, Alabama. He was on the Meredith March in Mississippi. He was with us on Solidarity Day. He was in Memphis. He was one of the first to help Cesar Chavez and the striking grape workers in California. Wherever and whenever the poor and the oppressed needed him, Walter Reuther was there. He knew that the gains of well-paid union men were endangered so long as there were other workers who were jobless, whose children were hungry, and who were denied their basic rights because of discrimination. Walter Reuther was a labor leader who never forgot that the American working man had to fight for what he has. He never forgot the sit-ins, the seized buildings, and the attacks by goon squads. He would have been shocked and ashamed of the recent action of some of New York construction workers who desecrated the flag under which they marched and who damaged the patriotic ideals they professed when they attacked students who asked for peace and domestic reform. For Walter Reuther remembered that the parents of those same workers were also beaten when they demonstrated for what they believed in. He was a great constructive force in the labor movement. He battled bigotry whenever it reared its ugly head, and his combination of militant unionism and fair play for all did much to lower union barriers to black workers. He worked increasingly to bring the light of fairness to his fellow unionists. Whether through his battles to counter the influence of Wallace support in the plants, or through his efforts to persuade other union leaders to take a stand on racism and the crucial issues of social justice. He was one leader who never had to be convinced of the justice of the claims black people were making on society. And he was one leader who never needed detailed interpretation of what was happening in the ghetto. He knew. He was there. He was a believer. He was a man. We served together on four presidential commissions. Always it was the same. He and I talked the same language, and together we had to spur on the businessmen and government officials who served with us to make them realize the crisis that our country was in, to make them open their minds and their hearts and to right wrongs. I saw how through sheer logic, commitment, and unswerving loyalty to humanitarian ideals, Walter convinced these men to support our positions and to back measures that would make life better for millions of the poor and the black. He was a symbol in his own time, a symbol of justice and righteousness. For black people, he was a symbol of the decency that still exists in America, a symbol of the concern and dedication of the important portions in some white America still remains. We thought of Walter the way he wanted to be thought of, as a brother, both in soul and in spirit, in word and in deed, a brother. Like all great men, he will have monuments to his memory, but monuments should not be of concrete and stone. True monuments are living ones. For us, his friends, his monument will be our memory of his dynamic personality and his continuing devotion and our continuing devotion to his principle. For the American labor movement, whose best and most enduring features he helped to create, there can be no greater monument to his memory than a rededication to his ideals of social change and justice. Let his tragic death be the spark that once again unites and ignites the labor movement to assume unquestionable leadership of those forces in our nation that are trying to build an open society dedicated to social justice and equality. Let it once more be the loudest voice of the voiceless, the greatest hope of the hopeless. Let his memory stand as a beacon for progress. Let his tragic loss inspire new effort and dedication to his ideals. That is a monument that Walter would have wanted. We grieve his loss, the loss of our brother, but we pray that the ideals that gave his life meaning will live on.